All right. I was going to say that sounds like Washington, D.C. with the skunks and raccoons picking up all the surplus, you know, all that nice trash that humans leave.
The last time I was in Washington, D.C., I was walking down the street and I was at like a tech meeting. I was with somebody I know from down there and I looked over and I just saw this gigantic rat. And I said, is that a rat? And he's like, that's a rat. This is Washington, D.C.
It's time for the Access of Easy podcast.
Yeah. So sorry for the delay. This is Access of Easy Salon 24 with Jesse Hirsch, Charles Hugh Smith. I'm Mark Jeftovic, and we are ready to go. Although I feel ill prepared today because I had to run out and do that run. So, what do you guys want to talk about?
Well, Jesse, I want to compliment your photo on Facebook of the happy creatures on your homestead.
Thanks, Charles. The motley crew I live with are both a joy and also an inspiration when it comes to animal content.
Well, I want to hear a little bit more about Big Mother. I think that's a great concept to explore in terms of the surveillance state and the network state. And so that's something we didn't have time to do last week, and then we have to work in a tribute to Eddie Van Halen one way or the other. We've got to use something. We got to talk about Panama so that we can, you know, pull a clip of that up.
Okay, so today's episode, I'm just gonna tick the demonetized box right now so we can just let it all have a free-for-all for the rest of the episode and just splice in stuff willy-nilly.
But to your point, I actually think talking about copyright is not such a bad idea. And I think it kind of relates to many of the themes we discuss. And I think it's very zeitgeist in terms of, I think copyright is something most people have the privilege to ignore. And I think most people have a very flexible, if not marginal, relationship with copyright. But it's as soon as you start producing, as soon as you start uploading stuff to YouTube, that you run into the algorithm police, that you get a sense of just how rigid, just how stupid, and in many cases, just how punitive copyright can be. And I think if more people understood the state of stupidity, there'd be more pressure to reform, if not abolish copyright as we know it. And, you know, I digress, but the thing that's caught a lot of the public's attention this week has been Fleetwood Mac's Dreams and the remix that a particular TikTok user who I wrote about in filming a video, you know, dramatically, I basically introduced the song to a whole new generation, but also created a really interesting type of spontaneous grassroots advertisement of Ocean Spray Cranberry Cocktail. And all of it, I think, speaks to the absurdity of the world that we live in, that all attention is commodified the moment that it's created. Like, I remember back, you know, 30 years ago or so, when I was sort of aspiring to be a content creator, and, you know, as Mark, I'm sure, was fantasizing about being a punk rock star, I was probably fantasizing about being a rap star. But, you know, all of that, I think, was couched in a culture of don't be a sellout, of you got to be true to your art, and can't sell out to the man, and wouldn't it be shocking if you did a commercial? And it struck me today, the moment you create anything, it's a commercial, and the company's going to co-opt it. It's going to be used to sell stuff. And so there's so much wrapped in this story of Nathan Apakadana, who's the guy who produced it, who created it. But I think it also speaks, Charles, to your point about Big Mother, that we often talk about how we are living in an authoritarian society. It's just like frogs in the slowly boiling water. We don't realize it. We don't encounter it. Our lives are still fine. And that's where Big Mother is a much more powerful concept than Big Brother, because it suggests that the surveillance society exists, that it's all around us. It's just so benign. It's so benevolent that we don't think about it. until we hit the electric fence, until we run outside the bounds of acceptable behavior, and that's when it shocks us pretty harshly.
Can I jump in with a quick thing on the copyright issue? So
as
a couple of failed content creators, Jesse, and you were talking about how backward the laws are, how would you see the content creators' livelihoods being protected if copyright itself were abolished? I remember a couple of separate episodes over my life. In my landslide days, we put out a CD, like a physical thing. And I remember I was living half the week in London and half up here in Toronto. And there was this bar I used to drink in, and it was like these younger Italian kids. I think they were sort of budding mobsters anyway. But I used to mind my own business, but they would tolerate me in this bar. And then we started talking, and then at one point, I gave one of them my CD and they put it on in the bar and they all just loved it. They said, yeah, okay, next time you're back and when you come up next weekend, I want a copy of your CD. I'm like, okay, no problem. Like, happy as a clam. Next time I come back from London, I got a box of CDs. I go back into the bar and like, no worries. Sammy lent it to us. We all taped it. And I'm like, oh, okay. Right on, you know? So, and that's just, you know, an old example, but now, when I
but
see
a frequent one,
yeah, and now the whole running EasyDNS, all the BitTorrent websites, and people sort of look to us as like, well, we're this bastion of free speech because we didn't knuckle under to the people who are trying to take down the BitTorrent sites. But I'm not really gung ho on these BitTorrent sites. I was gung ho on due process, and what I want is an actual legal due process before we take down somebody's website. But these BitTorrent sites that are, when I see my book on some guy's BitTorrent site, it's like, that's not cool, because that's not the book I'm giving away for free, but the one that I actually have on Pact Publishing. It's, I mean, the scale. But so my point is, where do you see the interests of the content creators? I mean, on one hand, I'll anticipate one thing you say. I mean, I always said if 10 million people or 100 million people downloaded my song for free, I just know that somehow as a songwriter or a musician, I would come out okay on that. But then along comes Spotify and Hulu and all these streaming services, and we know that that's not true. That you could be a starving artist and write a hit song that gets streamed 10 million times and you still can't pay your rent next month.
So you can't make many points and pretend you're only making one point. And, you know, there's much to respond there. And allow me to try to roll it backward and acknowledge some of your points and try to address your question while serving up Charles to continue the conversation next. I think a lot of it has to do with power, and a lot of it has to do with what the artist wants, what the artist desires. I would argue the third issue being livelihood and whether the artist can support themselves. Because not all creators want to support themselves. Many creators are hobbyists. Many creators are casual. So we have to first acknowledge that we're dealing with a very diverse marketplace. Secondly, you know, going back to the artist's desire, I mean, with your book, which would you prefer? A modest amount of money or a crazy amount of readers, right? You know, is it a modest amount of financial success or a greater amount of attention? And I think that's part of the trade-off that many people, especially creators, should be entertaining when it comes to where they fall on the copyright debate and where they're in the spectrum. But I think we've reached a point in technological advancement where we can have our cakes and eat it too. And that's why I think power is the number one issue. And that copyright has enabled monopolies, it's enabled cartels, it's enabled the concentration of power at a scale that does not serve creators, does not serve society. It only creates the kind of neo-feudal structure that we keep discussing in terms of a very small amount of copyright holders extracting rents from creators who use their content. Because one of the things that digital has taught us is that there aren't actually a lot of original ideas. That it's remarkable how many ideas are remixes, are simultaneous inspirations that are had at the same time in different places by different people, and how remix culture is actually kind of liberating. That when you're liberated from the idea of single authorship to the idea that we as a culture create things, I think that's really refreshing. I think that's why memes as a culture are now so dominant. That to be able to rip off, to remix, to regurgitate, to adapt, that's when culture's at its most powerful. And I don't think we should be limiting that. But to my point about having our cake and eat it too, you know, digital content fingerprinting has reached such a level of sophistication that there's no reason we could not have a simultaneously free market in which everything is out there and people get paid. In the sense that you freely download all the content you want, freely reuse, remix all the content you want, and still be able to quantify how people's contributions are used, where they're used, and split that money up. Now, as you kind of inferred, that's part of the Spotify model. And unfortunately, the Spotify model means people aren't getting paid squat, because the fraction of a cent that you get paid for a Spotify stream means that even if you are popular, you're still not making much money from that. And that's what I mean by power relations. That if you had, and I'm not proposing this, I'm just hypothesizing, a kind of, you know, hyperledger or blockchain-based content tracking system that was tied in to all the platforms that were all decentralized, that made it easy to track where it was used, how it was used, so that users of the song, fans, they could do whatever they want. There's no obstacles, there's no restrictions to them loving and using your content. And you're the creator, you're compensated as a collectivized pool that's able to then track and divvy up those proceeds in a transparent way that allows everyone to track how the system works and adjust it and vote and yada, yada, yada. So I think that's where the discussion should be. And I don't mean our discussion as the three of us, I mean society's discussion around the potential of copyright, because I think that we can have this dare I call it a utopia, in which copyright is banished as we know it insofar as controls, but authorship still exists and compensation still exists in terms of people being rewarded and incentivized to participate in such a cultural and commercial ecosystem.
Yeah, let me comment with the marketplace. In that, kind of going back, let's start from where we were, say, two generations ago before the digital era. There were gatekeepers, right? In other words, for Mark, there was record labels, right? A&R. And if you could get a contract, then you could sell a lot of albums and make a lot of money, right? So that was the gatekeeper you needed to get past. Then they were cartels, right? In other words, you had to pony up your, you know, $4.99 for your LP, or and so that was there was a price fixing. In other words, to get the content, you had to pony up a significant amount of money. You had to go to the theater to see the film or whatever. And so there was a lot of money changing hands, and so creators, if they even got a little tiny piece of that action, they could make a lot of money, because the quantity of money was just so amazing, right? Because at scale. And so even magazines, you know, it's hard to believe that people like Mary Higgins Clark, you know, the suspense mystery writer, you know, she got her start selling stories, and these, you could get paid like $100 for a story. Or even more, when that was fairly serious money. So there was the ecosystem of revenue streams was just a lot richer. And now what's happened is that's shrunk down to the point that, you know, we all know, like, say the music industry went from $15 billion in revenues to $5 billion. And so on, right? And so in my own work, I just got an email from some guy that I've seen on Twitter, and he said, one of my contacts had a question about your piece on this website. And I went to the website, and they've using my stuff, you know, constantly. And yet I don't remember giving them permission And so it's all like, I mean, I don't know. My stuff's probably copied hundreds of places, you know? And so it's like, and to say, well, is that good or bad? Well, let's just start with it is. But I think that the revenue decline in creative stuff has shrunk down to the point where there's such a scarcity of money that's partly why the YouTube rock artists and so on are trying to protect what dribbles of revenue they still have. And so that scarcity is driving the problem, I think, to some degree.
Although let me quickly push back. I don't think that the money has shrunk. I think the containment of the money has shrunk. I think the gatekeepers who used to contain and allocate that money, their share of the pie has shrunk dramatically. And a lot of this pie has ended up in the black boxes of YouTube, of Google, of Facebook, of Spotify, of Apple. And right. Because they're black boxes, we can't see those totals. We only see what comes out. And what comes out to artists is a pittance. So there is much more of that pie that I think is out there that should be reappropriated. And that's where transparency, I think, would go a long way towards this. Because, again, the Fleetwood Mac Dreams example, you know, they had a surge of people buying their digital album, their digital single. And it's very rare that we see that sort of activity. But I know that memes and similar cultural phenomena regurgitate songs all the time. You know, Genesis and Phil Collins had a resurgence only a month earlier. You know, Eddie Van Halen has probably had a resurgence this week, especially in terms of a lot of different Van Halen songs. So, I mean, I think the activity is there. I think the money is there. I think the black boxes are hiding the money, right? It's like at a casino, the way you're skimming from the top. And that, I think, is where transparency could identify how that money's being used and how to redirect it back to creators.
Is it a black box, or is it almost radical transparency is eating itself? Because it used to be the old model for, say, performance rights royalties. You get a song played on the radio. In theory, you get paid whatever it used to be, 2.5 cents every time your song gets played on the radio. And in fact, the stories we were told in college, there even used to be teams of people going across the country in motels, staying there for a few days, writing down the logs of the songs on the radio so they could take them back to headquarters and put them in the punch cards and calculate the royalties. Then, of course, fast forward however many years, now we're here, we have digital technology. We realize we're broadcasting over the internet, but where it's not an audience of 10 million people where you get 2.5 cents, it's one person. So we're gonna calculate what one person's share of 2.5 cents is, and it ends up to be that fraction of a penny with all those zeros in front of it.
I think the frame there is totally wrong. And I think part of that is when you were younger, you were more gullible. And now that you're older, you're far more skeptical. So that's why the things that existed when you were younger seemed more credible when they weren't, right? The sampling techniques they used to do for media research and media monitoring were grossly inaccurate. Like, you're right, they would send people to hotels. That's a terrible research method, right? Think about all the stuff they were missing.
Yeah.
And further, I think what you are right in alluding to is the difference between centralized and decentralized. Because it's not that it's one person listening to the stream. Because my point about the Fleetwood Mac streams is they just got hundreds of millions of streams in a week, right? But because they are all distributed and decentralized, they're not measured in the same way. But they are measured far more accurately, far more granularly than they ever have been. And that's where, in the aggregate, I think that there is a much bigger picture, both in terms of economic activity, but also in terms of what should be appropriate remuneration. Because, again, your earlier point, which I'm bringing up again because it shocks me, that someone could get millions of streams on Spotify and get paid $5. Which, if you did a concert for millions of people, you'd be making like millions of dollars. So that's where, you know, I find that the economy of this is a little off, because even though the cost of distribution is so low, that's part of why streaming is what it is, we know that these companies are making crazy amounts of money.
Let me stop you there, because I was about to jump in and say the lunacy doesn't end there, because there isn't a streaming service in existence that actually makes money. They're hemorrhaging money.
I wasn't talking about streaming services. I was talking about the digital monopolies.
Okay, so...
Because the nature of monopoly is subsidy, that you have a loss leader in one area that gets people back into your monopoly for the other, right? And so YouTube, you have a loss leader on music. As long as you keep people on YouTube, which gets them using Gmail, which gets them using Google Drive, right? So that's, I mean, the larger big black box, not the individual streaming company.
You jumped forward two steps, because I did want to talk about your article about the big tech antitrust this week. But let's get there first. So the system's crazy because you can have a hit song and still be eating dog food. And a bunch of tech nerds that created the biggest streaming service on the planet can become billionaires, but the streaming service they created is hemorrhaging billions of dollars a year because it's all underwritten by freshly printed money coming out of the Fed. And, you know,
so I agree with you 100%, but allow me to frame this discussion again. That's only true in the context of copyright. Because if you have a hit song on the internet and you don't have merch available to your fans, and if you don't have other monetization streams to capitalize on that attention, well, then you screwed up. Then you don't deserve the attention you're getting.
I think
that's how the industry has evolved.
I think there was a previous episode that we did where I talked about my former college prof for music industry arts, Terry McManus. I'll mention his name again. He manages the Birthday Massacre, and he said it's all about adapting to the new reality. So that's exactly what they did. And I'll link to it in the show notes page. I wrote up an article about it. It's actually my open letter to BitTorrent sites that are coming on to EasyDNS. It's like, if you think that you're here because we're gonna allow you to externalize all your costs and rip off all the content creators because we believe in your mission, you're wrong. And the mission that we do believe in is due process. But if you want to actually last in your business, this is how you have to start thinking about this. And it's kind of gets into the kind of areas that we're talking about today. Like, I even think BitTorrent operators should actually be initiating conversations with with licensing agencies and mechanical rights agencies and start negotiating blanket royalty fees. It'll never happen. I understand that. But if you want to last...
I mean, neither side is interested in that conversation.
I know, actually.
That's where I think there's a public policy opportunity to reform or abolish copyright. So you compel those people to talk to each other. You compel them to find a middle ground. Because I do think that piracy is a market correction, right? It exists because the technology is not being used by the industry the way it should. So they are using the technology the way the industry is not, and they're finding demand. They're finding people who will do that. And, you know, insofar as whether it's legal or not, I think that's irrelevant. What is more important to your point is that it becomes normalized. And it becomes normalized by having these parties find agreement. And that would be the role, I think, of government. Charles, bail us out.
No. I think you're right. There's a nexus there for regulation and some recognition of the market forces as they are. You know, I just want to go back real quick to the whole platform thing, which it's interesting how, you know, history is so compressed now, right? Like, you know, we often talk about stuff that the post-war era, which is 75 years old. And now if I mention, I just had the name of the first platform, MySpace, you know, where the idea was you would go on with your band and then you would have your merchandise and your CDs and stuff. And your fans would come on, and that was you didn't really have to share the revenues with MySpace. They tacked it on to whatever you were getting through, you know, adverts and so on. But now the platforms that we have now are, like, as you say, they're sort of like monopolies in a neo-feudal sense. and they appear to be open, but they're predatory. And I sent you guys an article from Dissent Magazine that I thought was, I didn't say I agreed with everything, but I thought it was really interesting that there's this sort of dual nature here. Well, our platform's open to anyone, you know, we're unbiased. And so, and yet we're the terms under which you agree to are predatory. And so, and I brought up MySpace because it was actually an interesting platform, because it wasn't, I think, quite as predatory as the existing platforms. And so, but to your point, and I don't have any insight to add to your point about how we need a new regulatory structure, I only want to comment that this is a point where you actually do need a central state, because somebody has to impose this from the top, or else you're left with a free for all, and then we get the BitTorrent and all my stuff copied wherever. And so, and one last point about livelihood, you know, you guys probably know that if you write a book for an academic press, you're going to be paid between $500 and $1,000 for that book total, right? Because you're never going to sell enough books to make back that advance. So you have to be a tenured academic, right? Or a government employee in order to write.
You have to have a day job.
You have to have a day job. And so, and there were lots of examples of this. Even professional football players back in the 50s they didn't make enough. They weren't, you know, multi-millionaires like now. They had a day job in off season. And so, but I think that's a constraint, right? If all you have is casual content creators, then, so anyways, I don't have any insight into how to regulate that other than to say, well, I hope micropayments or some regulatory structure would be imposed that we could all get a trickle.
Yeah, micropayments has been the holy grail that, I was about to say, will never happen. I like to think that it would happen. I mean, when cryptocurrencies came along, I thought this leads in a straight line to micropayments. Hasn't really happened yet, not in any coherent sense, but it does have a certain air of inevitability to it.
Yeah.
However,
Spotify, to your point, Spotify is a kind of micropayment. Yeah. It's just invisible to the user.
Right. And there's not a lot of options. Like there's no other platform that guarantees you 90% of the revenue stream or something like that.
Bandcamp does, I think.
Does it?
Yeah.
Okay.
And they're actually an EasyDNS customer too, so.
Excellent. Bandcamp. Yeah. Well, let's talk about Big Mother, because we're talking about the regulatory central state in a somewhat positive light. In other words, instead of imposing some sort of neo-feudal system on people, we see that there's potential for the central state to actually, you know, reduce the harm of monopolies and cartels, right? And so let's talk about the state as one arm of Big Mother, as well as the network state, Big Mother. I'm curious what you guys think about that kind of, you know, some things the state can actually impose a Big Mother regulatory structure that's actually beneficial.
So, I mean, the concept of Big Mother is very diverse. I mean, there's a lot of ways to interpret it. I think one way could be as the automation of the nanny state. So you take the concept of the nanny state and you add a kind of AI or automated element. Another way to look at Big Mother is to suggest that it's very responsive, that it's nurturing, that it's an approach to machine learning that's not just benevolent, but focused on people's best interests, right? So it's a subservient state, a state that serves the needs and interests of the citizens, and because of AI and automation is able to be responsive. You know, or you could take an even more sinister interpretation of Big Mother and describe it as the evolution of the opiate of the masses. That it's a way of literally nurturing or mollifying people to death, pacifying them, putting them into a kind of sleepy state because you're always taking care of them, creating a kind of learned helplessness by catering to their every need. So I raise that as a spectrum or a range of interpretations. But to speak more specifically to your point, Charles, you know, you could have a combination of centralized and decentralized response to content creation. You know, you were sort of suggesting that you'd need to have a state impose a kind of remuneration system or a content identification system, because if some people operate outside of that system, they're subverting it. But you could combine this by having decentralized surveillance. So automated surveillance that monitors all content everywhere, whether it's on BitTorrent, whether it's on YouTube, whether it's on CBS, no matter where the content is, this decentralized system uses a blockchain or Hyperledger to create digital fingerprints for all content, monitor, measure, track, trace, basically map out the expressions of the world. And then the centralized part is the payment mechanism. The centralized part could either be driven by taxation, where you're taxing the people who use the content, you're taxing the platforms that make money off advertising, monetizing this content, and then you're redistributing that taxed income or that generated income back to the people actually creating that content. And because it's Big Mother doesn't need a cut, so it's not for profit, it's directly distributed. Because that's the other aspect of an automated system, is its overhead would be very low. So in theory, you're maximizing the potential return to participants because you're able to keep that system lean and responsive in terms of what it provides as Big Mother. But the reason you don't call it Big Brother is it's not overarching, right? It's underneath, it's decentralized. You're not restricting what people can share. You're not restricting how they can share it. You're just saying, we're gonna identify everyone who's in this content and make sure that they're rewarded for it. So that's why it's much more of a nurture rather than an imposition. Although arguably, because it is Big Mother, it would still have some draconian or authoritarian elements to it that one could hypothesize if we were to carry this intellectual exercise further.
This sounds quite chilling, to be honest.
I did that deliberately. That's why my first definition was nanny state.
Yeah.
That I was trying to evoke this idea that it presents itself, it seduces you by offering its benevolence. Mm-hmm. But my own school of thought is no such total system can be free of, you know, malice because of the nature of such a total system.
Even if it didn't originate that way, it would iterate towards it and either be co-opted or just morph into from Big Mother to Big Brother.
To maintain the genre, the issue is gaming the system. How would Big Mother be gamed? Who would game it? And what would be Big Mother's response to people trying to game it? Because you try to game them, boy, does their tone change pretty quick. And they go from loving to pissed off.
You know, let's think about this for a minute. What do we have today that's already pervasive and ubiquitous, and we consider it a boon to our lives, and we would all freak out if it was taken away from our lives, and it's just part of the plumbing, aside from the plumbing, is electricity, right? We have electricity that just, we wouldn't be having this conversation without it. We were very comfortable because of it. Is there a same dynamic in here? That because all
you're leaving out. I feel you're leaving out a modifier, mm-hmm. and that's centralized versus decentralized.
I guess, because I was thinking all electricity is metered, right? Nobody uses electricity without some system knowing it's been used.
Most of my neighbors do.
Okay.
But that's my point, right?
Are they generating their own?
Well, they've got solar panels.
Right.
Right? Like, they are getting some from the grid, because the grid is there. But out here in the country, because decentralized energy production is increasingly accessible and affordable, most people at the very least are dabbling in it.
Okay.
And there are many people who are 100% energy independent. And I say this, sorry, go ahead.
I don't want to get too far in the weeds here, but I do want to pick up this thread a bit, because when I looked into solar energy, when I was thinking of putting solar panels on the roof at our old house, when I looked into it, I was disappointed to learn, and maybe I misunderstood it or things have changed, that I couldn't use my own electricity that I was generating on the roof and then just draw from the grid when I needed more electricity. Anything I put on the roof, any solar panels I put up, had to be sold into the grid, and then I just buy all my electricity from the grid.
Yeah, you're grossly misinterpreted or misunderstood. You know, I think, as per usual, your skepticism of the government and your sources of information may have slightly skewed your perception of what existed. So what you may be talking about was a government program that subsidized solar installation in the province of Ontario, which part of the subsidy did require that those solar panels be tied into the grid. But there is absolutely no law preventing you from creating, using technology to create a source of energy and use that energy on your own without putting it back into the grid.
So maybe it was just the vendor that I was talking to was in that program and said, this is the way the program works. You get it at this price because it happens like this.
The only way that vendor would sell to you was if you complied with their terms, which was your point, or maybe it was Charles's point earlier in the episode about, you know, oh yeah, it was you, Charles, about the hustle economy, that, you know, they offer you this thing, oh, you're going to get energy independence. But when you read the fine print, it's no, you're actually plugging into the grid and getting a terrible rate. But if you have literacy, if you understand technology, if you understand the market, you can do it for yourself and there's no problem. And that was my point about centralized versus decentralized, because that's a recurring thread in our podcast. And I think we, in a historical context, are really at a pivotal point in which the liberation, the proliferation of technology is allowing for phenomenal decentralized systems that threaten the institutions that exist today, that threaten centralized systems. And the only thing they can do to prevent us from embracing the decentralized technology is distract us or seduce us, right? To either distract us with propaganda or seduce us with convenience and keep us hooked into those centralized systems, when in reality, to Charles's point that he makes often, we could opt out. We could choose these decentralized systems and find a completely different way. And I think that's what you were alluding to, Mark, when you were talking about whether it's electricity, whether it's like food, whether it's education, whether it's work or money, all of these things. You know, we're reaching existential crises in terms of how those systems work. And yet there are alternatives that people are turning to in growing numbers that, you know, provide people with much more resilient opportunities.
Can I say one thing before I let you in, Charles?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. When we were talking about, Jesse, your point about having your cake and eating it too, where you would have distributed content and people could get the content for free and the creators could still get paid. And then somehow we made the leap that we got from there to, you would need some sort of regulatory apparatus, that's where you would need a centralized point to sort of regulate that. And I thought,
I didn't say you needed it. I just proposed as a scenario in response to Charles.
Right. But would you really, because what you were describing, what was going on in my head, and I'll say it briefly and move on to Charles, that sounds a lot like what Charles is talking about with Klein, where currency comes into existence when a labor-based service or a good gets exchanged, and it's not a top-down central bank printing money based on an economic forecast. It's like something's actually happened, and here this money comes into existence, and the person gets compensated. Wouldn't the same principle be possible in that kind of a anti-copyright regime, where people are listening to your content and the content creator, the system is seeing that people are listening to it and rewarding the content creator?
And to be clear, it's not anti-copyright, it's post-copyright.
Okay,
Charles.
Post-copyright.
Well, I think that's a fascinating comment, Mark. And Jesse, I think you're absolutely right with your summary of our constant theme of decentralization. being post-centralization in the sense that so many of the systems have been obsoleted, right? And but they're clinging on because they have the political power, even though they're obsolete. But Mark, I think you're really onto something there, because to your point about electricity, the only other option I can think of would be, just like everybody has a you have some taxes that are put on your mobile phone service, and most people don't look at it, but you know, it's $5 here and $10 here. And the same with your internet service, right? There's some, you know, the local government is getting some revenue stream for one thing or another. So if everybody had, you know, $5 a month content tax stuck on their mobile phone and their internet connection, and that was actually divided fairly, and of course that is a fantasy, that would create a pool of money for, let's say, a number around the creators, which would be in the tens of millions. I mean, we're talking about a major system for dividing a very long tail, right? But nonetheless, it would be satisfying. Yeah.
I'm specifically talking about the profits that the telecom providers make, which is far more than the taxes that the government takes. So yeah. You take their profits and you take some of those taxes. That's a lot of money to be redistributed, is all I'm saying.
Well, when that collides with reality, though, I mean, there's the CRTC is endlessly trying to introduce these kinds of content taxes up here in Canada, and the packages that they come in to try and get those through are usually pretty draconian and lopsided and not really going to be equitably distributed among the universe of content creators.
Yeah,
but we're talking post-copyright, so that means post-CRTC, because not only does the CRTC not do what you're describing, they don't do anything. They're pretty useless, right? So we're describing something that doesn't require the CRTC, but instead requires both a social contract, if you will, amongst a critical mass of people that says, yes, I want free content, and yes, I want creators to be rewarded for that content. I don't think that's a very difficult social contract to get people to agree to.
No, and what Mark's brilliant insight there is, if we were using a cryptocurrency that was created when somebody logged on or viewed or listened to content, it would be cost-free to the listener. They'd have no cost at all. And yet, if that were real money somehow, if that was a cryptocurrency that had value, then the creator would actually get something. And that's a very interesting concept, because technologically that's doable.
But absolutely. something in there is not sitting right with me. There's some sort of free lunch involved that doesn't seem possible. But
yeah,
well, we know your opposition to free lunches versus I am of the religion of free lunches. But I will point out very briefly that there are far smarter people than us in the cryptocurrency community. They may not be as wise or generalized as us, but nonetheless, there are a lot of people in the blockchain, cryptocurrency, distributed ledger technology world who have been working on this problem, because like us, they recognize that this is a very valuable problem to solve, and there's a lot of people who would like to see it solved. But fundamentally, and I think this goes back to why Charles was alluding or evoking the power of the state, the copyright cartels have a lot of power. And under no circumstances would they want to give up that power willingly or voluntarily. Now, you could imagine a scenario in which this distributed system rewards them for their power, and that's why they would participate in it, even if it would then decentralize their power and put that power into the hands of creators and users. But fundamentally, the reason that revolutions happen, the reason that revolutions are sometimes required, is sometimes power needs to be overthrown. That whoever has power needs to lose that power. And when it comes to copyright, that might be necessary in terms of getting to a post-copyright scenario, which is why I generally support my BitTorrent comrades in terms of creating an oppositional culture or an oppositional marketplace that does try to push the existing establishment or the entrenched incumbents into negotiation, into this new world. And I think that's where your point, Mark, of if the CRTC did this, it would be a clown show versus I think there needs to be some larger process in which this could happen. And, you know, if internet users could vote by numbers, I think you'd see that. That's where Apple, I think, was very successful in their initial intervention with the App Store. That, remember, before them, you know, albums still existed. You couldn't buy a single, right? They, you know, to the music industry, the copyright cartel, were still holding digital singles hostage by bundling them in albums of otherwise crappy songs. And it wasn't until iTunes started offering them for 99 cents each that the music industry was forced to capitulate. But now Apple's just another monopoly, right? So you take one gatekeeper, you replace it with another. So that's why I do think there needs to be some radical action. There does need to be a radical shift if we're going to get past the monopolies that we're currently beholden to.
So this is kind of interesting how this has kind of come full circle. I remember in the early 90s going to talk to a prof at Western and telling him my idea about being able to order songs a la carte, and then we would like, and this is before the internet. It was like, I don't know, we send them down the phone line or we burn a CD for them and mail it to them. And we were talking about all these different regimes involved in doing that. A few years later, the first web project I ever put on the internet was a music culture site called ShmoozeNet, Planet Shmooze. And we went and pitched Warner Music Canada about the internet and putting their artists online. And the CEO of Warner Music Canada at the time, Stan, I can't remember his name, was listening to us, this pitch about, well, tell me about the internet and what's going to happen. And around the same time, I missed a point. I wrote an article for ShmoozeNet called Major Labels See the Writing on the Wall. I think I actually wrote it after that meeting, because Stan looked at us after this meeting and he said, you know, all I can really say is I'm glad I'm close to retirement because I'm done. And he just saw that everything was about to change. And he said, so if bands can go on the internet and sell their music directly to people over the internet, what are they going to need us for? And we kind of gave them blank stares because we didn't really have a great answer for it. And the presentation kind of flopped at that point. They did give us a small deal to put this band called Salvador Dream to build a website for them. They got a little bit of a media buzz because if you did anything that ended with internet in those days, you got on the evening news. And now, today, a couple hours ago, comes across my Wall Street Journal news alert. Warner is restructuring because they're overloaded with debt and they have to figure something out because they're going down the tubes. But I guess what I didn't see coming is that we almost entered into this sphere where there are no winners. Like the whole, everything is cannibalizing itself at different rates of decay.
But there are winners. It's Google.
Yes, okay, absolutely. So the winners are yes, the big tech monopolies. Which we've touched on a few times, but we didn't actually talk specifically dive into it, like that article that you wrote today, I forget the title about it. And what I was going to note about that was a little off topic, so maybe I won't, but go ahead.
No, Charles, did you want to?
You're on mute
there, Charles.
Thank you. I just wanted to kind of say that, again, it, as these systems collapse, except for these monopoly platforms, like Hollywood in a way is collapsing, right? I mean, now that movie theaters are closed, they're really in collapse mode because they needed to game those ticket sales as part of their promotion.
Major League sports are collapsing.
Right.
So the Oscars are collapsing. It's all collapsing.
Yeah, and it's obsoleted to some degree. Well, let me just finish my point. I saw a reader sent me a video of a couple guys that had were trying a new model for making films. All right, these guys were already established filmmakers, and they spent like about 5 minutes explaining just how messed up it is to try to deal with Hollywood. You know, that you're promised this and that, and your film never gets made for one reason or another. So their model is now, they're saying, look, you, our audience that likes the stuff we put out so far, you tell us the kind of movies you want to see, and then, you know, you each pony up $5 and we'll make the movie. And so I don't know if that's going to succeed, but I liked the whole model, and it's very much like a Patreon model. You know, and I have a Patreon page, and Patreon is one of the few models that actually works for creators, because it's like, hey, you like my content, whatever the heck it is, comic books, documentaries, you know, text, whatever, then pony up $5 or $1, whatever. And this on at scale is like an income stream. So
my beef with Patreon, with Patreon, it's a good model, but they're well positioned to become yet another monopoly. Right. And they are a little heavy-handed with the politically correct, you know, being politically correct, and you can't color outside of the lines. But there are challengers like Subscribestar and I think BitChute as well. But what you reminded me, Charles, is that like on the old days, where mariners would raise funds and investors to take a ship to the New World and bring back a bunch of beaver pelts, and almost that same kind of. I don't even know what that model's called. It's Mariner or whatever, Voyager.
Colonialism?
I was going to say primitive capitalism, you know, you pony up a few bucks, and then if you do get the shipment arrives, then everybody makes a lot of money.
Yeah. Sorry, but you were going to say something, Charles. Or no. Jesse. You're going
to
say
no,
something.
No, I was just going to bring it back to the monopolies that, you know, one of the, so this week, a big congressional report came out that was a result of one of the more in-depth and comprehensive investigations in monopoly power in the digital economy. And one of its sort of core recommendations was to break them up, was to break all these companies up, to, you know, separate some of their core businesses so that they operate as distinct and competing companies, and so that you create a more competitive market. And I think that is one of the necessary steps. I think transparency, which is something we bring up here often, is also essential. I think the more that people understood how these black boxes operate, their scale, their power, the more that they would not like it, the more that they would desire and seek out alternatives. Because one of the arguments that these digital monopolies make in trying to say that they're not monopolies is that we're not bound to them. That we could switch platforms, that we could go to another service. And while technically that's true, there's all sorts of things that these monopolies are able to do to get their hooks into us. So I think in creating a more competitive landscape and making it easier for alternatives to emerge and become viable, and you know, the extent to which people have greater literacy as to what those alternatives are and how they could use them, I think we'll all create both a healthier marketplace and a healthier society. And I think that's why antitrust as a concept is so important, that we cannot and should not trust monopolies. And so once businesses get to a certain amount of market dominance, there's no reason to break them up, you know. And in breaking them up, you're still preserving shareholder value, because shareholders would still have shares in both companies, but you could then ensure a much more atomized or competitive marketplace instead of having the type of internal subsidy and shenanigans that we see these companies engage in time and time again.
That I can't even begin to describe the cognitive dissonance that invokes in me, because I agree with everything you said. And then I think the biggest monopoly of them all is the state. Who's going to break up the state?
It'll break itself up.
Yeah.
It's crumbling under its own accord.
The other thing that your article made me think about is and we're not going to play politics on this show, we usually don't, but just the observation that Senate report was a Democrat Senate report, and there's also impetus from the Republican side. Ron Wyden does a lot of work on the antitrust side, and I think he's done some bipartisan stuff as well. I can't remember who his counterpart is. So, and it actually, all of it is clueful. Like, I look at it all and I go, none of these are really terrible ideas. I can see myself nodding in agreement to them. And it makes me think that, it made me think a couple of things, but the general policy direction on both sides of the aisle is in the same direction, which then made me think about, yes, that's tension between the nation state and the network state, because they're both existential threats to each other. And I don't know who I want to win. I know I don't want it to be Google and Amazon and Facebook. I can guarantee that.
Well, I mean, let me two quick responses. One, I think what you're experiencing, and I'm being very elitist when I say this, is you're respecting internet literacy. You want politicians to understand the internet, and mm-hmm. the people who worked on this report on both sides of the aisle were those politicians, because they exist.
For a change, yeah.
Yeah, it's the politicians who are clueless about the internet that we're most afraid of, because we're living in the internet era and these guys still don't get it. And so to your point about the network state, it's here. Like, I think we should be embracing the network state insofar as we embrace any state ever, which is a worthy debate to have. But the network state has far greater potential for democracy and anti-authoritarianism than the nation state does. While the network state also has greater opportunity for authoritarianism than the nation state does, right? It kind of expands the possibilities when you think of the way the pendulum could swing. So that's where you want to be mapping out, okay, who are those potential champions of the network state who are on the Democratic side rather than on the monopoly side? And I, to your point, really admire is not the right word, respected. The Republicans who are making antitrust arguments, you know, even the ones who are doing so because of freedom of speech, I thought all of their comments were really quite well informed and nuanced, and it reflect not a civility in politics, but a reasonableness in politics.
Those are bygone days, aren't they?
No, they're not bygone days. They've never existed, and we're now creating them. Right? This is my point of nostalgia. Because we were younger, we thought it was simple, but in fact, we were blind to how stupid it was. Maybe that's a good point to end.
Maybe. There's their awkward pause right on schedule. Charles, is there anything you want to add to that?
Only that what we're talking about today, to me, I would sort of contextualize it as the systems we have, the institutions we have, are obsolete in so many ways. And yet it's difficult to see the outlines of what comes next, because the people who've been benefiting from these monopolies and cartels and power centers are going to cling on to the obsolete models until they really do crumble. And we're in that stage of crumbling. And that's why it's kind of awkward.
But allow me to riff off that metaphor. You know, Marshall McLuhan, one of his favorite lines was, when something becomes obsolete, it proliferates. When something crumbles, it becomes far greater in number, right? If you have a building and it crumbles, you go from one piece to thousands of pieces. So as these institutions crumble, they're replicating, they're becoming greater in number. So in an era where institutional authority, especially traditional institutions, are falling apart, they're asserting that more and more as a manifestation of their obsolescence.
I'm just going to reiterate publicly what I tell you privately a lot, Jesse, and that is, you've got to read The Sovereign Individual. And you have also, I think you did read George Gilger's Life After Google, which I think are both, today's episode in particular, very relevant. I would love to have either of those guys on this show. So maybe
send Gilder a note. You never know.
Well, James Dale Davidson is connected to me on LinkedIn, and we talked a couple years ago about an audiobook possibility, but he hasn't been responding. So I like, every once in a while, I'm like, you got to come on the show. I mean, who knows? We got Ben Hunt coming on next week. So hit hit us up on the comments and like us and tell all your friends to subscribe on Spotify and Stitcher and Apple iTunes. And thanks to the people who have given us some ratings on iTunes. I think we got 2 5-star ratings now, which is great. And then send everyone to accessofeasy.com, and we will see you next week. Yeah.